billions ahead. But the most important indicator is how much India's GDP per capita, based on purchasing power parity, or PPP, grows with urbanization. There are wide differences in this factor. The cost of living in Indonesia is much lower than in the United States and most other developed countries. Its actual GDP per capita in 2015, in U.S. dollars, was $3,346. But when adjusted for lower cost of living, it's $11,262. That's a huge difference. That puts Indonesia just below the global average of $14,717. This is important, as the linear correlation between urbanization and GDP per capita does not work nearly as well without the purchasing power parity adjustment, and it's more realistic. Figure 16.1 on the PDF projects that Indonesia's GDP per capita PPP at 90% urbanization around 2053 would be $17,500. That's 55% higher than today. This would be in addition to its strong population and workforce growth. That puts Indonesia in the upper ranks of emerging countries, which range from $7,000 in Kenya to $22,000 in Mexico, when they reach 90% urbanization in the future. Speaking of Mexico, mostly done, but still a boomer. Mexico is another example of a consistent urbanization and GDP per capita trend, but unlike Indonesia, it's close to maturity. At 81% urban, Mexico has a GDP per capita PPP of $18,232. That's higher than Brazil's and on the very high side for Latin America, with Chile higher at $22,197, followed by Uruguay at $19,952, and Argentina at $19,196. Its nominal GDP per capita in U.S. dollars is just $8,981. It projects to $22,000 PPP adjusted at 90% urbanization, which is 26% higher than in Indonesia. It's been more successful at entering higher-end manufacturing industries, which are 18% of GDP. But its rate of urbanization has been, and is now, much slower than Indonesia's. It's been urbanizing at a rate of 0.37% per year since 1985. It started much earlier, which is typical of Latin America. After hitting 80%, it slowed down, which is also typical of the region. Some countries never get over 75 to 80%. At this rate, Mexico would be fully urbanized at 90% by 2039. That's just in time for the next commodity cycle peak. It should be at its best between 2036, when the next global boom temporarily peaks, and 2038-40, when the next commodity cycle peaks. Brazil. Like an 87-year-old, but it can still surprise you. Brazil, the largest country in South America, had a GDP per capita PPP of only $14,535 in 2015, and it's already 87% urban, with very little potential for further gains. From 1985 to 2015, Brazil advanced from 71 to 87% urban, at a rate of 0.53% per year. It should peak at around 90% urban by 2020. Why would I suggest that you invest in a country that's the equivalent of an 87-year-old in terms of the most powerful life cycle and growth trend? Because Brazil will have a positive commodity cycle again from the early 2020s forward, as will most other emerging countries with stronger urbanization and demographic growth trends. When looking at urbanization and GDP per capita growth, you occasionally get miracles. Countries like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and Malaysia saw an S-curve, or exponential pattern, of GDP per capita growth instead of a linear path. Japan transitioned from an emerging to a developed country in three decades, the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Korea's baby boom generation followed Japan's by 22 years, and so did its S-curve urbanization cycle in the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s. No coincidence that Korea's baby boom peaked in 1971, exactly 22 years after Japan's peaked in 1949. All of these East Asian tigers now have developed world standards of living, with GDP per capita PPP ranging from $25,312 in Malaysia to $34,387 in South Korea, $37,872 in Japan, and a whopping $80,192 in Singapore. The only Latin American country to achieve this is Puerto Rico. It went from $7,000 in 1985 to $29,000 in 2015, after it was already 80% urban. I've never seen that before. What all of these countries have in common is that they transitioned to higher-end manufacturing and financial sectors with, of course, higher-paying jobs. 46% of Puerto Rico's economy is manufacturing, and the majority of that is in pharmaceuticals, biotech, and medical devices. Another 20% is in financial. Only so many countries can do that. Not even China, for the most part, has entered the higher-end manufacturing or finance sectors. Puerto Rico did that out of its close territorial status with the United States. Its major exports are mostly to the United States, and were launched based on favorable tax policies from the United States for pharma and related industries. The demographic trends are very different. Only in emerging countries are demographic trends second to urbanization, especially where there is a steeper curve on productivity, as in Mexico, Indonesia, China, and India. This is because developed countries are already urbanized and can thrive on increasing productivity only in the highest-end industries and services. When I analyze emerging countries, I use workforce growth instead of the 46 to 47-year birth lag for peak spending, because the difference between the incomes of older and younger workers isn't as large in the former. But frankly, using both the 46-year lag and the workforce growth approaches, the projections aren't that different. In terms of demographic growth ahead, Indonesia's in the middle of the pack for the Southeast Asian countries. It looks good, but it's not as strong as India, and it's nowhere near Kenya, the Middle East, and Africa. Look at its spending wave chart, figure 16.3 on the PDF. Indonesia has one of the longest demographic growth trends in Southeast Asia. It doesn't peak until around 2060. But it does plateau after 2045. That's another plus for Indonesia in the next global boom, from 2023 to 2036. Cambodia peaks way out into around 2070, with a plateau between 2055 and 2075. The Philippines peaks latest, around 2080, and it has the strongest demographic growth in the decades ahead. But would I bet on Cambodia or the Philippines between 2020 and 2035? I'll take Cambodia. So should you. The Philippines still has high corruption and stagnant urbanization growth. That's why you see Philippine workers everywhere you travel. They don't have opportunities in their own country. Then comes Myanmar, peaking around 2050, and Vietnam, with its peak around 2035 to 40. The country that has the highest standard of living in Southeast Asia is Thailand, thanks to Bangkok and its burgeoning tourism industry. Its GDP per capita projects as high as $35,000 at 90% urbanization. But its demographics already peaked in 2015 and turned down sharply ahead due to its higher urbanization and lower birth rates. Now let's look at Mexico's demographic trends. They're typical of Latin America. Not only does Mexico have very little urbanization opportunity compared with Indonesia, but its demographic growth peaks earlier as well. Then its demographic trends plateau between 2040 and 2050, before starting to drop off. Hence, Mexico will not look as attractive after 2040, and should be adversely affected by the peak in the U.S. spending wave around 2036. Colombia peaks the earliest, around 2030, with a plateau between 2025 and 2045. That's not good for the country, despite its growing tourism boom since it killed off the drug cartels. Brazil's peak is next, around 2035. Argentina's demographic trends peak the latest, around 2065, with a plateau between 2055 and 2075. In general, Latin America and the Caribbean follow Mexico's demographics, peaking around 2045 and plateauing between 2035 and 2055. Latin America will have demographics and the 30-year commodity cycle in its favor from 2020 to 2040, but not urbanization and the productivity from that. Still, it'll be a very good place to invest. Of all the emerging regions and countries, however, Southeast Asia and India have all three of the key cycles working to their advantage, especially urbanization potential and high rates of productivity combined. That makes those areas the ones to invest in. Not surprisingly, my number one rating goes to India. Its scale and underinvestment in infrastructure and its urbanization trends give it phenomenal potential. Add to that the first apparently progressive, pro-business government in its history, led by Prime Minister Modi, and India is off the charts in terms of investment potential. India is the only major emerging country to reach new highs over its 2007 peak because of this. In fact, India is the next China, unless they just blow it politically. India's strong demographic growth peaks around 2050 and then plateaus into around 2065. By then, it could achieve near-peak urbanization as well. Given its higher projected population growth and scale, it should be the greatest driver of global growth ahead, just as China was from the early 1980s to now. The country has been slower at urbanization, but that will accelerate. Its productivity from urbanization is already second only to China's since 1985. Myanmar's growth potential is 6.33%. It's the new rising star in Southeast Asia after the military dictators figured out they could make more money attracting tourists and not abusing their people in front of them. Cambodia is next, with a growth potential of 5.48%. It has high GDP per capita growth versus urbanization, and it will enjoy the highest demographic growth in Southeast Asia into 2035. Then comes the Philippines, with growth potential at 5.48%. But this will happen only if it starts urbanizing again and the downturn revolutionizes its internal corruption. Indonesia is in the middle, with growth potential of 4.50%. It has scale to its advantage, like India. Pakistan could be another surprising star if it can change its anti-Western, terrorist-nurturing stance when our geopolitical cycle turns back up between 2020 and 2036. It could even rival India one day. Right now, though, the country has the economic potential to grow at something like 4.0%. China comes in near the bottom, at a still healthy 3.93% growth rate, but I maintain that it'll take China more than 10 years to work off the excess capacity and debt it has. Finally, let's look at Latin America for comparison. The growth potential to the south. All these countries have little urbanization and productivity potential, as I explained earlier. Puerto Rico comes out on top thanks to its high productivity and concentration in manufacturing industries that cater to the aging U.S. population. But it has a debt crisis to deal with first, and it needs to stem the flow of people leaving the country for better jobs in the United States. that will flatten out or reverse only when the United States has a bigger depression, between late 2017 and late 2022. Puerto Rico has been in a decade-long recession and has unemployment rates just above 10%, but it still has the highest standard of living in all of Latin America, due to its strong high-end exports to the United States. Chile comes next, with the highest productivity rates outside of Puerto Rico, but one of the lowest demographic growth rates into 2035. Peru, with modest rates of both productivity and demographic growth, is next. Ecuador follows, with the highest demographic growth ahead, but one of the lower productivity rates. Uruguay has the lowest demographic growth rates, but a very high productivity rate. It seems to be the leading-edge country for expat migrants, with its pristine beaches and unspoiled soil for agriculture. My friend Doug Bell has been successfully raising money for agricultural investments and exports there. Argentina has the best city, Buenos Aires, and one of the higher rates of demographic growth, taking the longest to peak in 2065. But its productivity rates are on the lower side. Colombia has the worst demographic trends, with a measly 0.29% growth rate ahead, but a higher-than-average productivity growth rate thanks to its burgeoning tourism sector. Surprisingly, Mexico comes in second to last. Its productivity is slowing because its urbanization is low, at 0.48%, and its demographic growth is only average for Latin America. That was the biggest surprise to me, given how Mexico has risen as a substantial exporter in recent decades. The last place I would invest is Brazil. It's maxed out on urbanization, along with productivity on the very low side and low demographic growth potential. To summarize, the best emerging markets after the financial and economic reset ahead are in India and Southeast Asia, not China. And the growth rates there look to be substantially stronger than Latin America. So why not focus in on the best emerging markets region, Asia? The next commodity boom will also lift most emerging countries beyond these urbanization and demographic factors. We'll look at commodities next. The next boom will be more and more about emerging countries exporting commodities to one another. Now that's a trend to invest in. It will also be about wealthier developed countries investing more in emerging countries, as their own infrastructures won't be expanding much, if at all. Chapter 17. The Next Commodity Stars. There are two commodity-related sectors to put into your portfolio for the next big boom. Harry Dent. While the general 30-year commodities cycle moves like clockwork in the uptrends, it's a little less precise on the downswings, as I mentioned earlier. The tops in 1920, 1949 to 51, 1980, and 2008 to 11 were 30 years apart, give or take a year. But the bottoms were less consistent. The 1920 top took 13 years to bottom, which it did in 1933. The 1951 top took 17 years to bottom. The 1980 peak took 21 years to bottom, although much of that loss happened during the first 6 years after the peak. Now, the 2008-11 peak looks close to a bottom in the years ahead. The first peak in mid-2008 was driven by energy, industrial metals, and agriculture. The second peak in early 2011 was in precious metals and some industrial metals, like iron ore and copper. Oils and iron ore's respective 80% crashes are why I think this cycle could bottom by early 2020 or early 2023 at the latest. That means a major commodity boom is coming, starting between 2020 and 2023, and peaking around 2038-40. And this one could be bigger than anything we've ever seen, inflating as much as 4.8 times. The last major bubble grew only 3.15 times from the late 1960s into 1980. I always tell the gold bugs who argue that we'll see gold hit $5,000 per ounce that they're right, after they're dead. The important point to understand about commodities is that they have extreme cycles. That's why the best traders make their money in this sector. And sudden weather patterns or mining strikes can cause tremendous short-term fluctuations, often exploding like a bomb. Unless you're working with someone who has a proven system, don't trade commodities. You can invest in them, but tread cautiously. Remember that commodities are all different in their ability to ramp up supply, elasticity, when demand accelerates. It's easier to cultivate more land for crops or livestock in an era of urbanization, but it's not so easy to drill deeper for more oil or unearth more industrial metals like iron ore, coal, lead, nickel, and copper. Pulling uranium and the rare metals out of the ground is even harder. Also, commodities and the emerging world are intrinsically connected. Where one goes, so goes the other. As the emerging world dominates growth in the next global boom, it will need more of the basic commodities, from rice and corn to rubber, precious metals, industrial metals, and energy. The best way to forecast such future needs and appreciation potential is to see how different commodities performed in the last commodity cycle boom, from around 2001 into 2008-11. The last cycle also offers other insights, because it saw the first big surge in emerging countries like China and India. That will prove telling in the next cycle, as these countries continue to urbanize and move into middle-class living standards. Think about it. How much gold or copper or iron ore is there in the world? How much of what is there can we reach? There are always new innovations to find more, but they're often at higher costs. Take the energy sector, for example. Oil and natural gas. The fracking revolution found a way to drill horizontally and free up more oil and natural gas. But even that is not a low-cost innovation. Fracking can't compete with the lowest-cost large vertical wells in Saudi Arabia and Iraq. But it can compete in the $30 to $50 range and higher. Such an innovation is not as likely to occur for basic industrial metals and precious metals, at least not in a hurry. Fracking is an example of how an innovation can change an industry. It made oil, natural gas, and energy one of the most powerful bubble trends in this past 30-year cycle. But I don't see that happening in the future. Fracking puts a lid on oil and natural gas prices, as these wells can easily be started back up when prices rise high enough. We won't see sustainable $100 oil again. Or if so, it will be only in a short-term crisis, a larger Middle East war, during the upcoming worst 2 years of the 34-year geopolitical cycle. Andy also sees a potential oil crisis in this time frame with his histograms. I think oil will be in a $20 to $60 range for a long time. Hence, this is not the place to focus for investment returns. Oil will also be fighting electric cars, which look like a strong long-term trend. We won't see $14 natural gas again either. The trend toward clean coal is interesting, and we could see higher appreciation from coal prices in the next global boom. But everything in energy will have to compete with the swing producers in the North American fracking industries that kick in increasingly when prices get above $50. Energy and metals. Here, we're looking at three major sectors that have outperformed the TRCC-CRB index, and it's clear that the metals had the biggest gains. Energy was clearly the leading sector into mid-2008, and then crude oil crashed 78% in 4.5 months. That's the fastest crash I've ever seen from a modern-day bubble burst. Since then, oil and natural gas have become underperformers, and have lids on them from the swing capacity of the frackers in North America. Energy will likely be an underperformer for decades ahead. Precious metals did well, but not as well as the best industrial metals, like lead and nickel. The greatest secret is that the rare metals, like uranium and rhodium, did the best because they're rare. But they're also hard to invest in and extremely volatile. Adjusted for risk and volatility, for the next global commodity boom, precious metals and industrial metals look like the best sectors to concentrate in. Cement and agriculture. There are sectors like cement that are clearly critical to growing infrastructure in emerging countries, but cement's economics make it a local industry, not an international one. It doesn't make sense to export cement around the world because it has such a high weight size to value ratio. If you have cement plants, you can invest in the fastest growing countries, fine, but there's still the same factor of elastic supply. There's always more sand and water in most places. And agriculture, food, livestock, and textiles underperformed and had the lowest gains, respectively, although they still performed well during that last commodity cycle. Industrial metals. The industrial metals had some great performers between early 1999 and late 2011. Iron ore stood out from around 2010, but it doesn't look as good now, given the longer time frame and higher risk involved in mining it. Its 1,100% gain between 2001 and 2011 tops platinum, silver, gold, and most commodity sectors, except for rare metals like uranium and rhodium, more ahead. Uranium enjoyed a 19 times gain from November 2001 into June 2007. But again, when adjusted for time frame and risk, it doesn't come out of this cycle looking so good. That's why we'll dig deeper ahead. But overall, it's the precious metals that did the best when adjusted for risk. Note that of all the precious metals, gold has the highest application in jewelry and monetary backing and investment. Silver follows, then platinum. Platinum leans the most toward the industrial side, as it peaked in early 2008. When you buy platinum, you're really getting exposure to industrial metals, and, to a lesser degree, precious metals. Gold and silver face strong futures, particularly with Asians' love of wearing them as a show of wealth. China and India rival each other for spending on gold, but Indians spend much more compared with their incomes, and they're set to grow much faster than China in the coming decades. Out of the precious metals, platinum has higher returns, a bit more than silver, which accelerates a good bit faster than gold. But silver has the highest risk and volatility, and gold the lowest. Gold actually has the best risk-adjusted performance. The commodities that stand out are nickel, lead, iron ore, platinum, silver, gold, and coal. But we have to adjust for risk and time frame, which I'll do next. This changes the picture. The risk factor in commodities is always high, even in a boom. The problem with commodities is that they're the most volatile of investment sectors. This makes it more important to adjust for risk and to combine a number of commodities in your portfolio to offset one another. As we can see, we had a series of major peaks as early as 2005 in natural gas and as late as 2011 in gold in the broader commodity cycle that peaked between mid-2008 and early 2011. Soybean meal was kicking ass and was still rising into June 2016. Let me explain the figure 17.6 chart on the PDF. I look at when each commodity started to rise significantly and measure the times gain into when it topped. The standouts in this table are nickel at a 22.1 times gain, uranium at 19.2 times gain, crude oil at 17.7 times gain, soybean meal at 14.1 times gain. As you can see, the time frames can range from 6 to 10 years. That's a big difference. Soybean meal was the outlier, taking 16.25 years to peak. Commodities with longer bubbles of 8 to 10 years don't have as high an average annual compound return compared with their times gain as do bubbles of 5 to 7 years. To adjust for time frames in the second column, I calculated that average compound return per year in each bubble. Here the standouts are nickel at 56.0%, lead at 54.2%, uranium at 49.4%, iron ore at 47.4%, coal at 43.2%. This tells me that industrial metals take it hands down on returns in a bubble. Look to these as we expand into the next commodity bubble. In the third column, I consider risk. I first calculated the standard deviation during the bubble boom. Then I put them on an index, with 1.0 being average among all of these commodities. That means that more than one is riskier and less than one is less risky. The lower numbers are better. This is where the precious metals shine. Gold has the lowest volatility at 0.56. That was in the boom from March 2001 into September 2011. It's also been the least risky in the crashes since 2008 and 2011. Crude comes next at 0.65. Platinum, with its higher returns and industrial metal leaning, comes in at a surprisingly low index of 0.62. Silver is a good bit more volatile, at a near-average rating of 1.03. The commodities with the highest volatility include uranium at a whopping 1.65, iron ore at 1.43, also down near 80% after 2011, nickel at 1.24. Finally, I rated all of these commodities from highest to lowest by dividing the average annual returns in column 2 by the risk index in column 3. That means that a higher risk index lowers the risk-adjusted return in column 4, and a lower one raises it. The result? The top 5 commodities are lead, with a 57.9% risk-adjusted annual return, crude, with 55.4%, coal, with 46.9%, platinum, with 46.7%, nickel, with 45.2%. Gold does better than silver, with 34.5%. Tin does well, with 34.3%, followed by rubber, with 33.5%. Silver does well with 29.4%, and copper is right behind at 28.0%. Soybean meal, copper, silver, and uranium come out on the bottom when adjusted for risk. Note that many major commodities, from corn to cattle, didn't even make it into this level of analysis for outperformance. Of these top-performing commodities, you can invest easily only in those with exchange-traded funds or futures contracts. Only gold, silver, and crude have ETFs large enough to play with good volume. And I don't like oil and much of the energy sectors as much as the metals. The ETFs for platinum, copper, coal, and soybean meal are too small. Since a lot of metals are not accessible, some of the best, like nickel, lead, and iron ore, aren't even in the futures market. But there is another way to play this top sector. The multinational mining companies that focus on industrial precious metals and coal. These include BHP, Billiton, and Vale. What to put in your portfolio for the next commodity boom? In short, a good simple portfolio in metal commodities for the next great commodity boom should include the following 3 easily invested stocks or ETFs. Gold, GLD, Vale, Vale, BHP Billiton, BHP. We're looking at creating some other options to get into the better metals, like lead, nickel, and tin. Finally, let's look at the gainers and sustainers that will hand you profits in the aging developed world. Chapter 18. The Gainers and the Sustainers. There are only 6 developed countries that have substantially larger millennial generations, and they're all small. Harry Dent. When I look around the world, almost all developed countries have demographic declines over the next decade, although some, like Germany, are declining at more perilous rates than others. That means that, Despite the ongoing efforts by central bankers to keep this bubble going by way of endless stimulus, the outcome is inevitable. All bubbles pop, and each burst is always bigger than the last. With debt bulging, revolutionary cycles battering us from every side, and demographic trends growing worse, the financial crisis is going to be nightmarish. However, looking at the big picture, it's not all bad news. The gainers. There are 6 countries in the developed world with echo boom generations larger than the generation of their parents, the baby boomers. In rough order of demographic strength, they are Israel, Australia, Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, and New Zealand. The next global boom, between 2020 and 2037, will be dominated by the stronger demographic and urbanization trends in the emerging countries, and these few winners in the developed world will also be the best places to invest. Israel. In the long term, Israel's demographics are the most favorable. Indeed, they point up for decades ahead, as the country has avoided the steep decline in births that normally accompanies rising wealth and urbanization. Israel is also a leader in technology innovation. I am strongly in favor of investing in Israel once we get over the current unfavorable geopolitical cycle, sometime around early 2020. The other 5 countries do see demographic dips over the next decade, but then have echo booms that take them up to new demographic heights. Australia and New Zealand. After Israel, Australia and New Zealand have the most favorable demographic trends during the downturn of the next decade. Their trends point up slightly into 2018 and then down modestly into around 2025. After that, they have the strongest demographic surge. In the near term, Australia and New Zealand will be hit harder than their demographic trends would suggest because of the inevitable bubble burst in China, as well as their extreme real estate bubbles. However, the next great boom is likely to be dominated by emerging countries, which are more commodity-intensive in their consumption. This may spark the greatest commodity bubble in history, and Australia and New Zealand would be clear beneficiaries. Switzerland. This is the surprise in Europe, beating our past spending wave projections. This gain could come only from strong immigration over the past decade, which would make sense, given Switzerland's traditional role as a safe haven from the turmoil throughout Europe and the Middle East. Norway. The Norwegian economy is a little different, because oil plays such a big part. As a result, its GDP per capita is far greater than ours, and exceeds even the total urban and high professional services economy of Singapore. The big question for Norway is what role oil will play in its future. If there are major innovations in alternative energy, oil's place may be more questionable. And certainly, Norway would be hit harder than the other gainers if oil prices are below $30 a barrel over the next several years. Sweden. This is the other strong country in Scandinavia, with minor downtrends ahead and a larger echo boom to follow. However, it doesn't have the same strong ties to oil prices and exports that Norway does, making it more attractive as an investment. The sustainers. The group I call sustainers consists mostly of larger countries, including the United States, Canada, France, the UK, and Denmark, whose echo boom generations are nearly as large as their baby boomer ones. As a result, their demographic spending trends point downward over the next decade or so before moving sideways in the decades that follow. The United States. The USA enjoys the distinct advantage of being the leader in technological innovation. Holding on to that title will be critical for its future, as will its ability to continue attracting immigrants. Unfortunately, looking at demographics, U.S. immigration is already falling rapidly, and the current administration is not helping the matter. I forecast this phenomenon 20 years ago when I saw that immigration, like global trade, falls dramatically during downturns, and it often takes decades to rebound. If the United States, along with the other sustainer countries, shuns immigration during the next boom, it will be to its disadvantage, especially because births also fall during downturns. The U.S. birth rate has been falling since 2007, just as I predicted it would. Canada. This country is interesting because, like Australia and New Zealand, it should benefit from strong resource exports. Given what I've already said about the potential for a huge boom in commodity prices, Canada could see some of the strongest trends from the early 2020s through the end of the 2030s. However, the continued commodity bust will hit it harder than the United States in the next several years. The UK, France, and Denmark. In spite of their economic power, growth in these countries will be hampered by weaker trends across Europe. I consider them to be sustainers because their demographics will simply move sideways for decades. The key for these wealthy countries is to attract the best immigrants and technologies. Otherwise, their economies and markets may not see new highs for decades, if ever. As mostly English-speaking countries, the United States, the UK, and Canada enjoy a clear immigration advantage over the other two sustainers. But Australia and New Zealand do best in this category. But the key point here is that even in these modestly or higher growth developed countries, the baby boomers or aging sectors will tend to do best, as they had the strongest demographic surges, even in countries that have a larger millennial generation. Healthcare and wellness, pharmaceuticals and vitamins, biotech and medical devices, cruise ships, and best of all, funeral homes and nursing homes / assisted living, these are the sectors that will do best in all aging developed countries, and even better in the few that aren't aging as fast. Epilogue. Cycles and your life. We're all on a merry-go-round. Andrew Pancioli and Harry Dent. As we've shown throughout this book, events repeat as history repeats. This is a function of mass psychology. It's the behavior of the herd. But we have our own personal cycles as well. You'll undoubtedly have heard the maxim, "Give me a child until he is seven, and I will show you the man." This has been attributed to not only Aristotle, but also St. Francis Xavier. There's much truth in this, and in fact, it is the basis for one of the cycle sets we use. You'll be familiar with it. It's the 7-year itch. It's effectively the 28-year and 30-year cycles we've discussed, broken down into 4 parts, each lasting between 7 and 7.5 years. During the first 7 years, a child is totally dependent on its parents, particularly the mother. The next 7 years see the father playing a more predominant role while the child moves through puberty and begins maturing. The third phase sees experimentation and challenges in the transition of breaking away from parents into individuality. This is particularly so around the ages of 15 to 18, the first half of the third 7-year cycle. People gain degrees of freedom as they learn to drive and travel, experiment with alcohol and other things, and discover relationships. The transition is usually complete around the age of 21 or 22. Think about this. This is the point when many finish college and head out into the real world, taking us into the fourth phase. This is about becoming settled as an adult, having completely cut the apron strings. The 28 to 30 year point usually sees major life changes take place. If you were in a relationship that wasn't working out, then you'd find yourself moving on. Equally, you may decide to take the relationship to a higher level at this point, perhaps a marriage. If you're already married, this point may see the arrival of a child or a new home or a new city. Basically, around this time, there's major transition in your life circumstances. Then the cycle begins its second journey, which continues into the late 50s and into the age of 60. Again, each segment brings turning points every 7 years. And so it continues. No one completes his or her fourth 30-year cycle. But this 7-year cycle doesn't just apply to stages of your life. It fits into everything else as well. Every 7 years from the beginning of something, a degree of unease or change knocks on the door. You may decide to change careers, or you're promoted 7 years after you started that employment. Within your personal relationships, you may see challenges 7 years after you set out together, and then again after 14 to 15 years, and again after 21 to 22 years. After four of these cycles, larger changes in outlook and life can take place. When we apply this concept to professions, then we can divide these 7-year sections into development phases. Consider a highly qualified surgeon or doctor, for example. On this physician's journey to mastery, it's more than likely that he or she spent the first 7 years at medical school, learning all the fundamentals of the profession. After graduating, our doctor would have worked in hospitals and medical centers under the guidance of senior doctors, putting into practice everything he or she had learned. This is the second 7-year phase. 7 years later, they enter the third phase of their career. This is when they reach mastery. They branch out into their own specialist area and surpass in that field. They've done their 10,000 hours. As they enter the fourth 7-year cycle, they're the undisputed experts, and are then in the position to pay it forward by guiding the new doctors who follow behind them. Another cycle that affects our lives is this next one. Growth and renewal. The 12-year cycle is the basis for the 72 and 144-year cycles. Within our lives, it represents growth periods. We renew or restart an expansive period every 12 years. A dozen years later, you may see a good level of success. The populist movement cycle, which is timed at 84 years, is interesting. 84 is effectively 12 cycles of 7 years each, or 7 cycles of 12 years each. Can you see how all this comes together? The most important point in human life is the halfway zone, around the age of 40 to 42. This period in our lives is often referred to as the midlife crisis. Many have reached the top of their game. They feel they're peaking. The kids have left home. They feel unsettled or displaced. It's time to go out and buy that red sports car or a Harley. There is a real feeling of change in emphasis or direction. For some, it can represent an entire change in their lives. A lot of it depends on your belief systems, as ultimately you're in control of your own life and destiny. This is just a brief overview of how cycles can affect you as a person. There's a lot more to this. Much depends on picking the correct starting points from which the various dances of time unfold. But always remember one thing. The economy's life cycles are bigger than yours. You need to take into account not only when you'll make major changes or transitions in your education or career or retirement, in business or investments, but also what impact the economic cycles we've talked about in this book has on those decisions. For example, if you're thinking about retiring and selling your business 5 years from now, rethink it. The economy's life cycle would suggest you sell that business now, while it's worth much more than it could be 5 years from now, after the worst crash and financial crisis in history. If your kids are looking at going to graduate school, then the next few years, when job prospects are low, could be a good time to do that. Even a younger person with a long time frame for investing should be more conservative in his or her asset allocation in this economic winter season crash. Combine your natural life cycles with the economies to make the very best decisions for your life, your family, your investments, and your business. That's what we aspire to accomplish for you at Dent Research. For our free newsletter, or to get to know us better, simply go to dentresources.com. Also, check out markettimingreport.com to follow Andy's work. This is a fascinating science. And whether we know it or not, we are always partaking in it. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that thing which is done, is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 9. Economy and markets. The first e-letter of its kind. Expert economic forecasting powered by demographic trends, purchasing power, and cycles analysis. Harry S. Dent Jr. and his team at Dent Research believe that knowing what cycles are passing around us and understanding what consumers are going to buy next, or not, is the best way to protect your investment portfolio, maximize your returns, and make smart business and financial decisions. Each weekday in Economy and Markets, Harry and his team share their views on demographic trends, stock market research and trends, the housing market, different economic, market and business cycles, investment and 401k strategies, the looming market crash, commodities, and more. Economy and Markets readers discover when it's time to start profiting from the rise of specific emerging market economies, when commodities are likely to peak again, when the housing market will turn down again, and how other real estate market trends will change, when bonds would be a better investment than stock allocations, exactly what industries and investments will hand you the fastest profits, much more. Sign up at meetharrydent.com free. DentResources.com. Get a free report to prepare for the revolution. Visit DentResources.com today. Harry Dent has recruited some of the top financial minds money can buy. Their only interest is making sure listeners, like you, get the unbiased, independent economic research and investment recommendations you need to outperform everyone else in the market. He's been able to assemble one of the most experienced and most talented team of investment experts in the financial industry. DentResources.com has all the details of this team, including an in-house forensic accountant who has perfected a way to identify companies that manipulate their numbers, an industry veteran who has designed a simple but deceptively complex strategy to generate steady double-digit returns no matter what the market brings. Because one thing is for certain, baby boomers have money and they are spending it. A former financial advisor and trading desk manager who developed a proprietary algorithm to help him analyze important economic data and isolate trades in a segment of the financial markets that most people never consider. Treasury bond markets, and a market technician who has built trading strategies that identify short-term trigger events with remarkable accuracy, so you can make money no matter which way the market is moving. Plus, details of the proprietary systems and algorithms that each one of these experts has developed and painstakingly tested over decades to help you profit, and a special free report to say thank you for listening to the research Harry S. Dent Jr. and his team prepare for you. Are you ready to seize the day? Let us show you how. The Market Timing Report. Mastering Profits. One of the biggest challenges you face as a trader or portfolio manager is knowing when to enter or exit a trade or campaign. You get out too soon and miss out on profits. You stay in too late and see your profits evaporate. How different would your financial situation be if you could time markets? If you knew well in advance that a trend was likely to start or end, imagine how powerful that would be to you. Well, using cycles, we time markets well in advance. Our profit-finding oracle system highlights time periods when high-probability trend changes can occur. We also use our timeline that highlights market moves weeks, months, and years in advance. The Market Timing Report focuses on S&P 500, crude oil, gold, EUR, dollar index, is published monthly, provides high probability turning points and probability information, is derived from the Cycles Analysis Profit Finding Oracle program, is based on seasonality, cycles, and other proprietary methods, looks at forthcoming geopolitical cycles and events. Try it now. Get the edge. Find out more at www.markettimingreport.com. Do you need geopolitical strategic information for any business venture? Do you want to know where your business is in terms of industry cycles? Is a country you wish to expand your business in about to face major upheaval? Cycles Analysis provides specialist consultation in these and several other areas. Contact us with your needs at info@cyclesanalysis.com. This is Jonathan Todd Ross. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Zero Hour. Turn the greatest political and financial upheaval in modern history to your advantage. By Harry S. Dent Jr. with Andrew Pancioli. Edited by Teresa Fonden-Barcelar. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2017 by Harry S. Dent Jr. with Andrew Pancioli. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.